Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy. Our rugged tough guy is Nick Osello. And of course, we've got LK42 holding it down. Fellas, what a weekend of college lacrosse we got to discuss. How you boys doing?
Terry, I'm sore. I hung out with people who were more rugged and tough than me. So like on this call, I'm the most rugged tough guy, but it's been a humbling weekend to say the least.
Larkin?
Excited to talk ball. I think the storylines are really elevating and no different than March Madness and watching that play out in real time. I think that what started as, kind of no man's land in terms of like the bucket of elite, I think is evolving into potentially a really interesting May dynamic and bracket where for the first time, I think you can make a compelling argument for 8 to 12 teams here. So really, really excited to talk about the slate and to catch up.
I'm going to push back on the notion that it's the first time that you've been able to talk about 8 to 12 teams. I think it's like we're all the way back around. We're the snake eating its tail Ouroboros of this season. And it was like because of the combination of the games that were canceled early in the year and the like staggered non-conference strength of schedules, Duke, it's only now that, you know, the questions that we had about some teams and the answers that we felt like maybe we had around another, those have reconverged. And that's why I feel like your point is the right one, but I think it's like the second time. I think this is basically, we're back to where we were on February 1st. Let's start, because we're recording this at 5 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, with Sunday's games. There were two of them. One was more important than the other, but the other was more entertaining than the one that was more important. So we're going to start in Piscataway, New Jersey, where the Rutgers Scarlet Knights emerged 9-8 victors in double overtime against the Johns Hopkins team that on multiple occasions decided that it did not want to win this one. It felt for about, 12 minutes, 13 minutes of regulation, 4 minutes of the first overtime. So call it 17 and a half, 18 minutes that Rutgers was just going to let a second winnable Big Ten game slip through their fingers in as many weeks. But ultimately it was Casey Mungillo in regulation and Hayden Sommer in overtime that said, not today, Blue Jays. Larkin, what do you have on Rutgers and their advancement to 8-3 on the season, 1-1 in the Big Ten?
It's a huge moment in the Big Ten season, because I think that this is one that caught a lot of people by surprise, right? We kind of have the Maryland storyline and will they respond and get off the mat, right? We have an evolving Penn State group that, when Aquino's healthy, I think many people believe is maybe the most talented team in the conference. But below that, I think most people thought Hopkins on paper would at least take care of business against Rutgers and Michigan, setting up, you know, a potentially interesting bubble dynamic where they have to win like a Big Ten semifinal game, perhaps, to like guarantee their inclusion in May in the tournament. But what we saw today, just to get into like the granular details, I thought Rutgers' slide decision making to Collison was quite fascinating, and really
they
what
went
we
so
saw,
fast and so hard.
So fast and hard, and just so everyone understands, what they're basically signaling to the world is we're going to no hedge help off Chauvet, so we're not going to let him beat us with six goals, okay? We're going to go from the fucking parking lot, literally from the hot dog stand, to Collison.
Pre-struck.
And basically dare any other human being with a Hopkins short stick to beat us in space. Like, they're all attacking General Dill short sticks who are rotating off of, you know, Phil Help, and Hopkins couldn't beat him, right? You go to Piscataway, you only score 8 goals. I mean, that's not good enough to win. And this is also one where it's just such a tough bus ride home, because I felt like Hop was the better team. And if you cut the tape into the efficiency of the possessions, like, they really should have won that game. And they should have been able to elevate and separate somewhere in the early third quarter. But credit to Rutgers. Big play late. I mean, hammer goal from the top of the key with, you know, under 5 to play. And, you know, the bench responds. And once you're in OT against an old school blue blood, like, Piscataway is not a fun place to go to. Like, it's windy, it's cold, it's weird. And that is a massive win. Like, that is Johns Hopkins that Rutgers just beat. And Credit to those kids, and I'm sure they're gonna have a couple cold ones tonight.
Nick, do you know why, or did you know that most of the campus is in New Brunswick, but the stadium's in Piscataway?
No, honestly, the less I know about the state of New Jersey, the more proud I am of it.
My take on this game was it was through, call it about 35-ish minutes. Well, actually, I know exactly the moment. When there were 13 goals on the board between the two teams, there were 11 combined saves. And so the notion that it was a rock fight was true, but, you know, it because of the way that the goalies have been playing and Carden Stoller's reputation, I think, you know, most folks would have thought that the low scoring was attributable to the goalie play, and it really wasn't that. And I also, you know, I do think that like College Cross tweeted about the just terrible shot quality, both in terms of where on the field the shots were being released from and also like the actual shots themselves. And I think by the time the game was over, that was true. But at that point in the game, it really felt like the reason it was so rock fighty to me was because of the quality of defensive ground ball play in offensive zones. I thought at both ends of the field, and Carson Brown, to me, you know, if Hopkins had won, probably would have been the player of the game because of how many contested ground balls he came up with in difficult situations. And so, you know, it was a little bit of a unique game for me in the sense that the low scoring nature of it was, in my opinion, a reflection of that dual combination of bad offense that got the ball on the ground in pre-shooting situations and then good defense that came up with it. So there were just a lot of empty possessions, but it was both ways. And I felt like when the game flipped, it was really more about it's interesting because I agree with you, Larkin, that in many ways it looked like Hopkins was the better team, but ultimately in the last 16, 17 minutes, Rutgers got so many better scoring opportunities. There was a 2-minute non-release, or I don't know whether it was non-releasable, but a 2-minute hit to the head on Colin Cordilla where Gelinas made two saves and then Colin Kelly hit two pipes. And it was just like, for me, you know, again, on the heels of covering the Ohio State Rutgers game last week, it was just like where, you know, it really felt like for them, they were like, oh man, we had this win and it slipped through our fingers. It felt like it was happening again. And then for Hopkins to get three stops in the last 5 minutes and then, you know, with 12 seconds to go, throw the ball out of bounds, which set up that final clear that gave Mongiello the opportunity for the buzzer beater. I mean, you know, it was a Rutgers team that just felt like it was and I think you can chalk it up to 9 or 10 separate occasions in the last 11 minutes, unable to make that final grasp at victory until literally the last possible second, whereby at the other end, you've got a Blue Jay team that felt like they were going to be able to do just enough to get to escape until, you know, they made ultimately one too many mistakes.
To Larkin's point earlier, what, you know, I will say I didn't have a ton of respect on Rutgers' name going into this. My bad, fellas. Correction noted. But I was watching this more with a critical eye on Hopkins than I was, you know, a good job Rutgers. And what was curious to me is that we're too late in the season to have a defensive strategy saying we are going to take away X and Y and you have to beat us in Z. And Hopkins' inability to beat those, you know, early slides and recognize the defense's game plan and have the talent and collective IQ to make the adjustments in real time, it was honestly pretty surprising for me from the get-go. The second point is, Larkin, you and I have talked and made some similar agreements, and this is through my Notre Dame alumni lens about how they're going to be a team that is going to win games or lose games. You know, kind of they're going to drag down to this defensive battle. It's going to be 2014 Notre Dame ball. They're going to win or lose 7-8, 11-9, whatever it might be. And I think that that might apply to significantly more teams than we had originally thought. Looking at Rutgers' last two games, I think we can argue that Rutgers is this way and Ohio State is this way, which only gives more credence to the fact that, you know, here we are back again going, who can really confidently beat Ohio State or Rutgers? Because these games are just going to be single score rock fights.
Yeah. So I'm so torn because, and Quinn called this out in my, or in his column last Monday. And, you know, my point of view in general is just to be opposite of whatever Quinn's point of view is. So he's like, scoring is down. And then I do the actual like goals per game and it's up. And, but at the same time, like, yeah, there are a lot of instances of what you just described. And then, but on the other hand, we just see Syracuse Duke 16-15 and 34 goals in Princeton Brown. And, you know, there are a handful of other, you know, Colgate Navy, I think, was 31 goals as well. So scoring is not down, but in a lot of these high profile matchups where the tension gets most ratcheted up, the games we've had more low scoring games that were high profile than, again, I feel like we've had in 5 years. And without continuing to beat the same drum, I have to attribute it to the lack of veteran offensive talent. And we are coming off of a 5-year run where we had more veteran offensive talent than you had ever had in the history of the sport. And it was compounded by the implementation of the shot clock for the first time in 2019. So, you know, this is a perfect storm that has been reset. And now we have to figure out what college lacrosse actually looks like. Let's talk about a game with 24 goals in it. 17 of them went to the North Carolina Tar Heels, who beat Harvard 17-7 at Archbishop Spalding, a Corgan Sports Live event, a game that I was planning to attend until Kevin Brown decided to go and bailed me out from having to deal with the parking situation. So thank you, Kevin. But I was unfortunate to miss. This would have been a good one from a lot of different perspectives. Ultimately, it's kind of interesting because I picked Harvard. I have been the number one vote for Harvard since they beat Syracuse. And that's a reflection of a couple things. Number one, when they beat Syracuse, in my opinion, it was the best win on the board. And they had not lost since. That was the reason that, you know, I don't draw teams for not losing. One of the things about that game that was particularly important was, you know, jury burn teams, because sometimes they have meatheads from Wheat Ridge take faceoffs, have traditionally been not that good facing off. The Harvard teams are no different in that respect. And, you know, against Johnny Mullen, not only did they face off better, but it also, you know, kind of and over the course of this season, whatever, to the extent that it had been a deficiency, proved to not be such an issue. However, that was not the case against Brady Wambach. Carolina ended up winning 23 of 27, and Wambach picked up 12 ground balls and tossed an assist. It's very difficult to overcome a possession disadvantage that substantial. Larkin, your thoughts on what you take away from the Tar Heels in a game where Owen Duffy had 7 goals?
Well, it's obviously a statement result. It's putting the nation on notice. I think the call outs that we've held Carolina responsible throughout the season has been games in which Duffy kind of looks human, and a ton of pressure that then places down the table on some of those young freshman midfielders who have super high end talent, but maybe aren't the types of people you want carrying the rock deep into May. They have an elite clamper. We all know that. And you know, can they just get a little bit more efficient on defense? Right. I think we saw a lot of that today. Like, I want to give Harvard an immense amount of credit. Like, I obviously went to a school that's a league rival with Harvard. Like, I'm not here to give them flowers, but the reality is, in a season where many people thought they would take a step back, losing Sam King, who realistically is one of the best ball-carrying attackmen that program has ever had, like, they've started this season in fantastic fashion. They're in no way playing cupcakes. Like, they beat BU on Tuesday, who I think's rock solid, right? They've beaten, you know, like, Penn, Dartmouth, Michigan, Syracuse. Like, they are doing the right things to put themselves in a position to play their best ball in May. I think it makes a ton of sense to me that eventually they would stub their toe. I think there's going to be an immense amount of pressure on that first midfield group to continue to elevate and get efficient as they get deeper, because I think their face-off game, not just their clamper, but their wings are just okay. And I'm not sure they have like an elite cover one defenseman. I think highly of Charlie Muller. I think they're playing a lot better this year. I want to give Jerry credit for getting the unit heading the right direction, but they don't have like a Bobby Van Buren or a Sean Light or like an eraser, right? So because of that, there's going to be games where Graham Stevens needs to elevate to really win his matchup. Today was not one of them. Like, he didn't save possessions for them. He was just okay. And, you know,
but he has won them games so far this year. He's shown that he's capable of it.
Definitely. He's good. He's long. He's athletic. I think he commands the defense well. But like, Owen Duffy was the best player in the field today. And when you combine that with what many people will vote, you know, as the first team All-American clamper, right, you can get lopsided results. But to be clear, like, I think these are both tournament teams. I think they did the right thing testing themselves at a neutral site. And this is a game that ultimately will really be a feather in the cap for the Tar Heels on Selection Sunday.
What's interesting to me, you mentioned Jerry Byrne and the collective face-off unit and super tough, rugged guys from Wheat Ridge, maybe not the best clampers. This to me was a cascade of everything that could have gone right for Carolina and everything that could have gone wrong for Harvard. Not all face-off dominant performances are created equal. And I would argue that Baptiste being a part of that 2015 DU team and Wambach being a part of this UNC team are two pretty good examples of it, of what you have to do. And what I think Coach Byrne always did a good job of was understanding that you're going to lose the face-off battle, or at least at bare minimum the clamp battle, but not have that weigh on the momentum of the offense. Always have two or three things in your back pocket, whether it's a John Sexton, Matt Landis, whether it's, you know, a D-Mitty, just to force the clamper or the face-off guy to go back and then throw a little 10-man on him. Not even necessarily, you know, trying to get a possession, but just trying to disrupt the flow of the opponents. And I think that Wambach has proven to be not just a good enough clamper, but athletic enough and a good enough lacrosse player to be where Baptiste was kind of towards his junior, senior year, which makes it an incredibly difficult matchup to even stop that momentum. And UNC, with, I would argue, the most potent offense in the country, you know, it's to me, it put every other team on notice saying we have to be prepared for junking up and messing with the momentum of this offense and finding ways to shut down Duffy and making them beat us in other ways. Because for a team to put up 17 on a damn good Harvard defensive unit, you know, to kind of parrot Larkin's point, this to me was the statement of the weekend.
I wonder why you're trying to sell that it was the statement of the weekend, but we'll get to that in a minute. Pick up and carry on that point. You know, Matt Baracco went 3 of 12 facing off, but committed 2 turnovers. Brady Wambach only committed 1 turnover. So I think that's ultimately where, when you're at a significant face-off disadvantage, you overcome that possession overall disadvantage either by riding the ball back or by protecting the ball offensively. And Harvard was only +3 in turnovers, right? It committed 15 turnovers to Carolina's 18. And you're always, whenever you see a team, you know, start to roll offensively, it's going to yield some more aggressive passes, which are the types of turnovers that you're okay with because they generally yield really high scoring, high percentage scoring opportunities. And at the other end, you know, that's when you can't throw those passes, right? You've got to try to grind down shot clock and get the best looks that you can through the, you know, just continuing to hit singles element of your offense. I think your point is incredibly well taken, Larkin, that it's impressive what Harvard's been able to do in light of Sam King's graduation. But I also think that Nathan Covery being held scoreless is a reflection of what that means in terms of the instability is the word that comes to mind. But what I'm really trying to say is just the growing pain nature of it, right? You know, last year it was Jack Spidell and Teddy Malone in supporting roles. Now they're in lead roles. And Nathan Covery is the guy who needs to, you know, take a step forward in terms of his experience. And he's doing that, but there's no replacement for it. And so it just requires time in order to do it. And I think that that's where it'll be so interesting just to continue to watch Carolina over the next few weeks, because typically the narrative around Carolina is they peak in early April. And, you know, by virtue of the academic calendar and some of the other things that go on in Chapel Hill, you know, and how they have tended to have an additional bye week late in the season, that, you know, you see them kind of flying high on April 8th or April 15th in South Bend or in Durham or in Charlottesville, wherever it is, and they look incredible. And then, you know, in the first round of the NCAA tournament, they need overtime to get past Marquette. You know, that's a it's been a pretty consistent theme over the last 25 years. The difference is when you're relying on a second midfield that's exclusively three freshmen, and the question is, are they going to hit the freshman wall, or are they going to continue to get better because there is so much internal improvement available there because they are so young, and we know that they're going to be so impactful on the future of this team, especially, you know, it doesn't feel like the goal is to get to 50-50 runs between first and second midfield lines. It feels like it's just a matter of time until the freshmen become the first midfield. You know, and Mason Suchek and Caden Harshbarger and Luke Macaluso are running number two. And that in and of itself is a very daunting prospect. But I'm not there in a put the country on notice kind of situation yet. I will have them number two behind Richmond in my poll on Monday. I do feel confidently that they are the second best team in the country right now. But I'm still going to reserve some of those traditional questions about what we see from Carolina when April turns really nice in Chapel Hill, as opposed to just pretty nice, which is what it's been over the course of the last 2.5 months. Shall we get
moving on to the Carrier Dome
Saturday action? How do you guys feel about Delta Star Field? It's pretty cool. It makes it look like the Death Star. I don't know how many other fields have corporate sponsors. It's on the grass in both Scott Stadium and in Klockner. Nick, you want to talk a little bit more about corporate sponsorships, or do you want to get to the result?
Corporate sponsorships have always been what listeners tune into. If we could spend about 20 more minutes on that, that'd be great.
I'd rather you tell us a little bit about what happened in Notre Dame's trip to Charlottesville.
Okay, you got me. Notre Dame lost. You know, Klockner has historically not been, at least in terms of the dome, in terms of Koskinen, in terms of some of the other, you know, kind of elevated stadiums that have the historical aspect to them. At least speaking personally, and Larkin, feel free to chime in. Klockner was never up there with like the this is the most intimidating stadium ever, and Notre Dame got caught. Final score, Virginia 11, Notre Dame 9. It was objectively a pretty good game to watch. It kind of felt like a slugfest of who has the better, more physical athletes, who's going to make the additional save, kind of brawled their way throughout the entire game. Ultimately, Notre Dame came up short, and the red flags that we had kind of been raising since the end of the Kavanaugh era came to fruition. This is Notre Dame's third straight game without being able to crack double digits with a loaded offensive roster. And Virginia held Notre Dame scoreless for, I believe, a 19-minute stretch in the third and fourth quarter. And I think that was a good combination of Virginia playing good physical defense, not backing down from any individual matchups, not being too slide heavy, trusting their guys, and also good goaltending. I think this is the first game that Virginia has been able to say goaltending was really the battle that we won today. And I don't think anybody would say otherwise. You know, kind of from the Notre Dame side, there's certainly some things on the offensive end that you need to address, but I wouldn't argue that this is a team that we expected to run the table and go undefeated. Would I have liked to have that been another game kind of later in the year, whether it's Duke, Syracuse, UNC? Yes. Given that Virginia hasn't been the best program this year and hasn't had the best season, but you know, the classic adage, hey, maybe it's good to get picked off right now so we can, you know, reassess, rehuddle, regroup, and come out firing on all cylinders next week. So I don't know, interesting matchup with Notre Dame Richmond next week, but not going to try and, you know, duck any analysis from you two. Terry, what did you take away from it?
Well, so I was at the homegrown classic, a public high school lacrosse triple header at Westchester Ruston High School. So this was second screen for me while I was watching. I believe it would have been during the Ruston Urbana game. My observations or thoughts are a little bit more like sporadic and episodic. I find it interesting, and I don't know if it was just because of the way that I teed you up, that you go to the environment as being a factor in the outcome. It certainly was notable that there were 3,800 fans there. It was a really nice day, but even still, given the way the team had performed, I was impressed by that crowd. I think it's also worth noting that Virginia was coming off of a win over Dartmouth. And I think a lot of folks looked out the corner of their eye, side-eyed a little at Lars's comments after the overtime loss to Maryland as being, this is the turning point in our season in a positive way. But, you know, with the benefit of, what would that be, 2 weeks of distance, it is true, right? I think, you know, it's pretty hard to argue that we haven't seen that come to fruition. Your point is the correct one, right? 11 saves out of Jake Merrick, 9 goals allowed. It's hard to win against really high quality competition if you can't get to 50%. And so that was impressive. Andrew Greenspan has solidified a little bit of the faceoff position. I'm sure that he enjoyed competing against his old team after he transferred out of Notre Dame after his freshman season. You look at it and Virginia was +3 in faceoffs. They failed 7 clears. Notre Dame failed 4, which would suggest that the possession battle was basically even. To me, one of the most interesting things, and I thought the broadcast did a nice job of pointing this out, was sending Dylan Faison onto the field with 9 minutes to go in the fourth quarter for the first time, and what that says about the way in which this group was offensively trying to wrap their arms around how they were going to score. You know, you mentioned the 19-minute drought to end the game, and at that point it was halfway through, right? So they had felt it a little bit. I think the source of the identity question, in my opinion, offensively, is we potentially have at least three available options in terms of our number one initiator. Geometrically, it probably is best if it's Josh Yago. Programmatically, it's probably best if it's Matt Jeffrey because he's a sophomore and you have 2 more years left of him. Or Teddy Lally, but he's a lefty, so there's a little bit more righty-lefty balance out of Jeffrey and Lally. So whatever. And not only that, but he's a freshman. So might not be the best thing for this year if you're relying on a freshman to do that. And then on top of that, you've got middies in Seymour, Angrick, and Maharis, and maybe even Finley, who can all do the initiating. And as we've talked about, when this offense is clicking and humming and doing its best, what we want to see is those guys setting up Luke Miller. And that, for me, was the problem. And without being able to pay close attention to the film, I can't speak to how much of it was Virginia's defense. But what I will say is that if a lot of it was Virginia's defense, then kudos to Lars Tiffany and Virginia, because that shows that they have patched up what was not only their biggest deficiency, but potentially, I mean, based on what we saw in the Hopkins second half, like, there are arguments to be made this might have been one of the least buttoned up defenses off ball in the top 40. So to then turn around and limit Notre Dame to 3 assisted goals is really impressive. Larkin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I became the, bell cow for defending my old bench boss who left me. And, you know, I have conflicted feelings about this, but I feel fairly vindicated, frankly. Like, I think that the national dialogue had gotten so dramatic, both about the potential end of Lars's tenure, but also I think, frankly, what I would describe as like a disconnect from the data on like how bad the product actually is. And I know I went on that long-winded rant on the side-by-side comparison of Brest versus Lars and their sample size, but like, just to be specific, last week we called out that we thought Kevin Warren's defensive midfield group really underperformed in the dome. Like, he is a midfield first defender. Hedge, help, communicate. They then resoundingly responded at Denver, right? Like
they Lars certainly is did.
Lars is a defensive coach. Whether he's the right fit at UVA, with the decision they make, I don't know. But I do know this. He probably has not slept in like the last 8 weeks because of how bad they were off ball to start the season. So this is not shocking to me at all. Like Virginia is in no stretch like fixed completely. But the idea that they could find a way to elevate Hudson Houseman and the rest of the short stick D-mid group to a place where they can create triangle help, not have to low fill, like, you know, isolate matchups and have a plan with where we're coming from, be decisive in who's helping and why, and put Notre Dame in a position that, frankly, they've always been in, which is like Notre Dame for decades before Matt Kavanaugh and Sergio Perkovic got there, and Nick won't like this, but it's the truth, was the number one team out of the ACC that if you're really bad, you would pick to play because you can get them a little bit out of sync potentially and into a rock fight because they play multiple midfield lines. It's hard to get them in sync and they all look the same. So it's like they're the only team that maybe you could convince like Lehigh to play like 8-7 in 2008. You know what I mean? Like Lehigh wasn't going to the dome against like the Pals and like slowing those guys down, right? But the Kavanaughs sped Notre Dame up and they generated two or three goals on the ride, right? And they did things in a way that is frankly special. And like Notre Dame's still really good. They have great wins this year already against, I believe, Georgetown and Maryland. Like there's no question in my mind they are a threat down the stretch here. But this idea that they're like invincible when historically the Corrigan precedent is like Big Ten football. Like it's a little bit more Kirk Ferentz than I think the new age of Notre Dame fan is willing to admit. So credit on a human level, like credit to Greenspan. Like he transfers out of that locker room. I'm sure it was a really emotional day for him. Like he, you know, like put his dick in the dirt, so to speak, and showed up. Like he won his matchup. Merrick, the whole world's basically been saying that UVA doesn't have
DID, baby, DID.
Like the whole world's been saying UVA can't get a save. Like that kid was a super high end recruit. I'm sure he's been wearing that on the chin. Like have some pride in your process. He won his matchup. Like the Millens, the whole world's been saying those guys aren't that good, blah, blah, blah. They look pretty good to me. Like I don't want to really guard those guys. So, you know, I'm torn, but I'm happy in the sense that, like, you know, I think Lars's defensive IQ should not be the reason he loses his desk if he does. Like that guy's a grinder.
What I will say too is Notre Dame historically has played games in this fashion, right? Outside of the Kavanaugh, especially the when Pat and Chris were together, Kavanaugh. But even dating back to Matt, you know, you ask what was Notre Dame going to win on, you almost wouldn't go right to a better offense, a better defense, a better face-off unit, better pushing in transition. You would just say there's an X factor. And whether it's Matt Kavanaugh or both the Kavanaughs in the ride, whether, you know, again, and I'll take 2021 to 2024 almost out of it, just because those teams, you know, their rosters just get out of their way and watch them work. But, you know, that's what I'm leaving this game with is where is our X factor where we can flip the script, get two goals quickly? You know, whether that's Sergio Perkovic in the fourth quarter just doing what he does, whether that's our 10-man ride that, you know, allowed us to beat Albany back in the early, you know, 2010s, whether that's, you know, going way back, a Zach Brenneman who can just shoot a lefty on the run 13 yards and it be unstoppable. I'm curious where this X factor is. And I did think this was kind of funny as I was looking at this. As far as Virginia's defense improving, dating back to the Hopkins game, they give up 14 to Hopkins, then play High Point, 13 to Towson, 13 to Maryland, 11 to Utah, 7 to Dartmouth, and now 9 to Notre Dame. Like they're kind of just chipping away at becoming a pretty good team. And it just made the UVA Duke game, especially with Duke coming off a good offensive performance, at least it made UVA Duke way more of an interesting game. And honestly, I'm kind of curious and I'm not rooting for Virginia. Let's not have that be the case. But I'm excited that I'm not writing them off Not that I, you know, was officially writing them off because they have good talent, but I'm more excited to see how they wrap up their season, Larkin.
I think the other thing that's elevating is their transition play. Like Hopper is still super, I think, green on the back end. Like I think he puts himself in spatial trouble at times with how he hedges and a little bit of how he engages on ball. But like, to be clear, he is going to be a like generational offensive threat type coming forward, like Scott Ratliff, you know, that type of impact on the game, partially because of where he plays. Like it's so hard to get Kevin Corrigan to let you run. Like because he plays at UVA, he'll be able to go in transition. So I want to call out that I think UVA is getting better coming forward. I think Hausman is like really good, and I think Hopper's trending, let's call it. And the other thing I want to call out to defend Notre Dame now, they still have an X factor that if on Monday of Memorial Day weekend, on no rest and short scout, you want to guard Joey Spallina or Owen Duffy, Sean Light is still the best and most athletic player in the country to do that. And that is like a massive strategic advantage. So I think that like Notre Dame is still in a great position. Now, this is setting up for a huge weekend in Durham where I think, you know, we're going to talk about Duke Cuse in a second, so I'll hold some of my thoughts for that. But massive moment there. And to set the table for UVA, their RPI just got, like, overnight transformed. So Undertaker meme, like, up out of the coffin. Now it's a question of can they win another one? Like, I think they have to win one more ACC game to put the math in their favor. But their season is back alive.
I want to react to you teed up like 5 points that I want to make perfectly. So the first is to your victory lap about being the defender of Lars. Like I also want to make one thing clear, which is, you know, this time last year, you know, my burial of their season was around their prospect of putting together an NCAA tournament worthy resume. And, you know, ultimately felt vindicated by that. Right. Never adopted that approach this season. I mean, up to and including yesterday and going forward, they have every opportunity still in front of them based on, to your point, the metrics that they've had and the available wins that are still there. But, you know, what I was reacting to was not just the contract of the reality of the contract situation, but more so just, you know, what we saw out of the, you know, really more than anything else, the Hopkins and Towson games. And so that's why I think the focus over the last three games, Utah, Dartmouth, Notre Dame, ought to be on the improvement. And you know, again, to an extent, the Maryland game, and it's not even about that. It's also about the resiliency shown by being able to wear that loss, right? That loss is really disappointing because it was so useful and so close within your grasp. So once, you know, you're kind of in a desperate situation and you miss out on that opportunity, it's like, oh no, you know, that can be really deflating and that can be very compounding. So kind of dug that hole even deeper. I'm glad that you brought up Hausman and Hopper. I want to add Joey Terenzi to it. Obviously, he scored the goal with 1 second left at the end of the first quarter and then had another tying goal late in the fourth quarter. So it's super important. And I think it's also reflective not just of the ability to manufacture offense in games in score situations where you're not going to be as successful 6-on-6 as you might need to be be able to rely on in other settings, right? Like this team has been incredibly proficient 6-on-6, but you know, in the third quarter and the fourth quarter, it really wasn't happening at the same rate. And so, you know, to get those game winning plays in transition was super useful. We got to talk about the Hopper over the head check, and I want to do so in the context of, did you hear Kark compare him to you, and how do you feel about that comparison?
No, I was unfortunately watching the Stanford Cardinal lose to Villanova. No, what did he say? Was it a chirp?
No. We just said, like, Robbie, well, first of all, I didn't hear it either, but it was in the Inside Lacrosse Slack that he just compared him to Larkin, and I would assume it was something along the lines of his offensive prowess.
I think that here's what I would say. We have very different games, frankly. I think that...
You mean because you're not 6'5"?
Well, partially frame, and like I think I take a lot of pride in things that he still needs to dig on, specifically the way in which he angles and supports his short sticks. But let me say this, like, it's unfair that so many people compare poles based on just the points they get, if that makes any sense. Like,
yeah.
The truth of it all is, they're all very, very different players. Like Hopper's upside, I saw someone compare him to Earhart on Twitter as an example. They're so different. Earhart is like a cover one World Games MVP who you can put in a phone booth with any attackman on the planet and like he'll like erase him, right? Like what Hopper could become elite at, and the reason he probably went to Virginia, which was smart, frankly, is it, as the game slows down for him on defense and he can start to time his breakouts and, you know, double teams and get more aggressive off picks and timing up trails. Like if he can cause turnovers and get the ball on the deck, like he is very good going forward. He's an offensive defenseman. Like he is, you know, to use a hockey expression, he's a Quinn Hughes or a Cale Makar. Like, but, and this is a big but, when you go to the ACC and you play in the ACC, your job as an LSM first and foremost is to support your short sticks because you are not playing in the Patriot League. You are not playing against like lesser than athletes. Like you are playing massive. Sergio Perkovic's coming downhill on a shorty. And like it is your job to support and triangle help so that no one has to low fill off the pipe so that they don't need to slide. And scramble below GLE matchup. So you know, he's just green. But, like, first of all, thank you for the comparison, Kark. I appreciate it. But I would just say we're really different. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and to kind of drill that point home and a little bit tee up the next game that we're going to talk about, Billy Dwan, incredible offensive pull. Very different from, like, he's producing points in a much different way than Robbie Hopper is. I'll respect your comment that it's hard to compare these guys, but I actually think the two guys that are pretty similar are Mac Christmas and Robbie Hopper. I think that the manner in which, you know, it's a mindset first thing, right? Which is like, why am I on the field? And I, in many ways, it's because I want to score goals. And you can kind of see that. To the last point about leaking out, it comes with a threat. Right, it comes with a cost and a lot of risk. And if you want to see that on display, watch the last 90 seconds of Virginia's trip to the JMA Wireless Dome in 2024, and just keep your eye on Ben Ware and see what that means for Syracuse's prospects at winning that game. Let's go to the JMA Wireless Dome. Nick, are you prepared to talk about this one?
Yeah.
Do you know what the score was?
Yes, I do. 15-14. This was one of the couple games I started watching the highlights, and then I was like, okay, I need to go watch this game. You know, browsing Twitter and then saying, oh, I need to go put this on. And boy, am I happy I did. You know, we use the term slugfest back and forth affair quite a bit. I feel like this one was almost the perfect embodiment of it. You know, to set the stage, Duke had not had a difficult schedule coming into this. There were questions surrounding, hey, you know, is this going to be a good Duke team? Is it going to be a bad Duke team? We don't know because they haven't been tested. The Dome has proven to be Syracuse's, you know, complete X factor. They don't lose in there. And, you know, kind of throughout the game, it was just a beautiful display of two teams playing their brand of lacrosse at a very, very high level of execution. It was everything that we've kind of hoped, I think, from Syracuse's offense from a consistency and game ending standpoint. There weren't big lulls where they were trying to do too much, too, you know, kind of too fancy, get too quick with it. But at the same time, there were the one-handed cross crease pass to an immediate quick stick. You know, on the opposite side, Duke just has a roster full of guys who are freak athletes that can create separation, score, turn it down, and, you know, S dodge and, you know, make the plays that they needed to make. And ultimately, you know, the quote in the Inside Lacrosse article about Gary Gates saying, I'm proudest of the way that we finished the games. Like last couple games, we haven't had good fourth quarters, and this is the way that we need to finish games. You know, I think it said a lot about the growth that quite frankly has been missing from Syracuse this year, on their home turf against a conference opponent. And, I don't know. This to me was a beautiful display of lacrosse, and there's no other way that I can frame it other than go and watch it. It's two different styles, both equally beautiful and enticing, and a slugfest that came down to the fourth quarter. Ultimately, Syracuse comes away with a pretty important win. I get too excited sometimes, so because like I just realized I didn't mention any names. I didn't mention any stats. I just talked about how awesome and cool of a game it was. So, Terry, maybe you can fill in, you know, some of the nerd details.
Well, I just want to clean up that it was 16-15, not 15-14. Samsonite. I think calling it a slugfest and framing it that way is really appropriate. My reaction, and to Gary's point about being proud of the way they finished the game, is I was most impressed by the way that it... I'll continue with the flight analogy. I was impressed by Syracuse's chin. It felt like they were able to take every Duke punch and just stand there. And they, you know, the old, I think it's a Tyson adage, which is everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. Like they just got punched in the face and they didn't deviate from their plan. I thought it was so impressive and a demonstration of growth. And again, if we're talking about in the context of the season long basis or the 4 year class of 2022, reinventing the orange, Joey Spallina led group, whatever, then this is the final stage. This is the big bad boss. This, not Duke, not this Duke team, but the being able to, going back to when they were freshmen, my whole thing has been, they have to learn how to win. You do not show up knowing how to win college lacrosse games. It is a process, right? And it's a tiered process in the context of understanding how long the season is and what that does to what the demands it puts on you emotionally and physically and being able to level up to that, right? That takes a year. And then they, you know, bring in Princeton's grad students who had been at the Final Four. So they have Final Four experience, but ultimately you have to understand the difference between winning a first round game versus winning a quarterfinal game versus winning a game on Saturday, right? And their sophomore year, they demonstrated that Denver knew what it was going to take to win a quarterfinal game and they did not. And then they take a step forward and they win one of the best games of 2025, an absolute shootout against Princeton. And they demonstrate that they have learned how to win on quarterfinal Sunday, I guess. And then they run into Maryland, who nobody knows how to win better on Saturday in the NCAA tournament in the Final Four than Maryland does, right? And so now this is the last step. And I think that continually taking the punches that a team like Duke throws at you and not deviating from your plan is a good regular season demonstration of showing that you're where you want to be. I want to point out, for anybody that is a Syracuse hater right now, they're number one in the country in RPI and number one in strength and schedule. So if the season ends today, they are your hands down number one seed in the NCAA tournament. And as Larkin aptly says all the time, that goes a long way toward determining the quality of the matchups that you're going to see, not just in the first round, not just in the quarterfinals, but in the semis and in the championship game sometimes as well. So with that table set, Larkin, your thoughts?
I mean, it was a great result. I'm going to take a contrarian view.
You love it.
Partially because that's how I roll, but also just to set the table. Like I've been very clear that I think Syracuse is 2 to 3 goals better in the dome. Like and the Final Four will not be at the dome this year. Okay.
Wrong.
This played out exactly as the dome gods intended. Syracuse had 3 incremental extra man opportunities, 2 of which, in my opinion, were hyper questionable. Okay. So I want to just say, I actually thought Duke showed pretty well. I thought Duke, you know, eight turnovers versus 12, right? They actually outshot him, punch for punch, heavyweight fight. Remember, Syracuse has the number one strength schedule in the country. Duke has been eating cupcakes for the last 2 months. This is their first real test. So to play the contrarian, as someone who picked Duke to go to the Final Four, I actually thought the Duke, the film and the efficiency level on both sides of the ball, they did not get saves, so that's one call out. I think you can make a pretty compelling argument that when you consider that you just told me Syracuse is going to be the one seed, I think you get on that bus and you're bummed. And you know, listen, this is a man's game. We got pride in what we do. Obviously, that's a quiet bus ride home. But I think Duke's back to work on Monday, thinking that hey, we're one of the best, you know, 3 to 4 rosters in this nation. And if we start trending heading into May, you know, we have every opportunity to run the table. So I think this was just a great lacrosse game. This is why you buy the tickets. This is why you take the kids, as they say. And it was fun to watch. And by the way, all the knowns showed up. I mean, all the big boys, right? Like, if you just look at the stats, Sloat, Ortley, Johnson leading the way for Duke, Spallina, Anderson, Thompson. I mean, it's everything you want.
9,304 fans in the dome. And that, you know, I say it should be there. What I'm referring to is the fact that, you know, because of the World Cup and Gillette Stadium having to give the championship weekend back and Lincoln Financial not being able to take it because they're also hosting World Cup games. Now we have the tournament back on campus, or the Final Four back on campus, and it's going to be in Charlottesville. It's going to be awesome. But my point is that if we're going back to college campuses at some point, we need to get back to the Dome because there have been some epic championship games played there, and it's been too long. Hey, man, maybe one day we'll play it at Notre Dame Stadium. Don't yawn at me.
Yeah. I'm happy to go to the Dome as long as we get some forensic accounting on who's reffing that game and, like, where they live and, you know, who their, like, in-laws are married to and whatever.
I also want to point out...
There were some questionable calls.
I want to point out the switch from Patrick Jameson to Henry Blake, the Ohio State transfer, and then John Donosky post game saying that, you know, he was kind of constantly throughout the game thinking about whether or not to go back to Jameson. John Donosky goalie management is a story that dates back to Danny Wigreiser at least, and it might go even farther back than that. So it'll be an interesting story to continue to follow. And then the last thing, I'm not somebody who reacts very strongly to what people say, although I do want to touch on one of their social media conversations about a commentator's comments about a player's in-game comments. Before we get to that, though, Joey Spallina basically saying he didn't play well because he had 6 turnovers despite having 2 goals and 4 assists. Nick, what are your thoughts on that? Is that a show of maturity and leadership that you like, or is that maybe a little bit of, I don't know, I don't want to call it like hollow talk, but, you know, maybe is that just, is it coach speak? Is it player speak?
1,000% player speak. and I don't know Joey well enough, but like at a certain point, and I only had a very brief run of being a guy who would be like interviewed after a game. You know, it was usually the Cavs, the Perkovics, the whoever else. But when you try to show personality, you get in enough trouble and you just kind of end up saying the same things over and over again. If he had 15 points and Syracuse won in a blowout, you know, it's just such an easy thing to say. Again, not knowing Joey, I was always saying, okay, how quickly can we wrap up this interview? What can I say? Because we got cold ones on ice waiting at the lacrosse house after a big, you know, top 10 win on our home turf. Yeah, no, I, you know, had a couple turnovers, so, you know, didn't play our best, but, you know, it's a good game. Okay, can I leave now? Because, you know, the table, the cups are racked, and, you know, me and Roa are going to be running the table tonight. So that's, well, yeah.
One more game to get to in earnest. Yale 13, Cornell 12. You know, the Bulldogs had been lurking as a top 20 team. Their win over Boston University was certainly the most substantial, kind of eye-catching one. The loss to Penn last week, you could call it a quality loss, but you probably needed another data point to pair it with in order to have a sense for what that meant. And, you know, to kind of continue on with the theme of withstanding the punches, I think it's impressive Yale got out to a 4-1 lead. You know, it was 2-0, 2-1, 4-1. And then Cornell came back and tied it 5-5. And from there, kind of controlled things over the course of the second quarter to take a 9-7 lead into halftime. Yale used a 4-goal run over, call it a 10-minute stretch from the end of the third to the beginning of the fourth in order to build a 12-10 lead, and then really kind of held on, white-knuckled it down the stretch for sure. Peter Moynihan gave him a 2-0 cushion with 2:52 remaining. What's interesting is, so first and foremost, and I've done this exercise with Yale in the past. It was a win over Penn State. I want to say it was probably 20, 23, where I basically evaluated, maybe it was 20, it was probably 22, where I evaluated each of their goalies' 17 or 18 saves on the basis of whether or not it was a save that you would expect a goalie to make because it's what the look that the defense wants to give up versus one that you wouldn't. And use that in an effort to try to evaluate, like, how sustainable is this defense by goalie, I don't want to call it strategy, but performance. And Ben Freeman put up 20 saves. Matthew Tully only made 11. So, you know, that is obviously a significant delta in terms of that part of the field. The other thing that, you know, is kind of impressive is they got balanced scoring. 10 guys produced points. But Sean Grogan and, to a lesser extent, Connor Gately had been the production leaders. And so for Moynihan to put up 4 goals on 7 shots showed a little bit of an additional element to what they were able to produce. And then at the other end of the field, you know, certainly blanking Ryan Goldstein on 8 shots is a hell of a day, a hell of a day. So, you know, really just kind of all around a thorough victory for the Bulldogs. And, you know, we've been talking about, to the extent that we've talked about them so far this season, we really haven't a ton, but it's been, you know, this is a young, it's not even that young of a group. It's just a very inexperienced group, and it was going to require some time in order for that experience to develop. I thought that Penn loss was really damaging in the race for the number 4 seed in the Ivy League tournament. They were basically going to need to steal one of these against Cornell, Princeton, or Harvard. I would have bet on Harvard being the one that they were able to steal against, and they were going to need Penn to drop it, which, candidly, it looked a game against either Dartmouth or Brown. Like, those were basically their paths to that 4 seed, and it looked like Penn was immediately going to do it as they were trailing at one point 12-6 at Dartmouth, but came all the way back to win that game. I believe the final was 16-14. So, yeah, all in all, just a really big and important win for Yale that now does throw that kind of Ivy League tournament pathway back to the NCAA tournament back into consideration for them. And, you know, maybe raises a few questions around Cornell. Worth noting, Jack Haskaden took 4 faceoffs, but faceoffs are not the reason that Cornell lost. Michael Malkonian, who's been their backup prior to this recent Haskaden injury, won 16 to 25 and picked up 10 ground balls. So what has the ability at times to be maybe not a strength, but at least a neutral spot on the field for Yale. The faceoff X was a deficiency, and they were able to overcome it in order to secure this win. Larkin, I know you always have thoughts on your league. What did you take from Yale's win over Cornell?
Well, first of all, boys, I make one joke about the refs in the dome and, like, full Wi-Fi cutout. So that just shows you the way the world's listening these days. Palantir took over Starlink, like, I was down. Just everything out. So I think the big call out about Yale this year is Yale might have found a goalie. He is trending, and I thought he was the difference on Saturday, having watched back now about half of it so far. Not just his save volume, I think he ended with 20 versus 11 for Cornell's keeper, but also the quality of the looks. Like, a great example being Goldstein late clock in the fourth, I think, to tie it. But I mean, the truth of it is, like, Yale's well coached.
Hold on, before you move off of that point, because you were trying to get back on while I was making this point, what's your interpretation of how many of those 20 saves the defense should give up or wants to give up? Like, basically good looks for the defense to give up versus how many did he steal?
A little bit of both, and you just teed up the exact reason why having an above-average goaltending variable is so important when you're making decisions about how you can defend. Like, because Shea, I think, trusts him, they can be a little bit more aggressive in the depth of how they hedge and their willingness to go and their willingness to attempt to eliminate knowns. And, like, if he doesn't feel good about certain short stick matchups against Princeton or Cornell, like, he can do things, he being Shea and their new defensive coordinator, to try to fix that. Like, Yale has a culture of recent success. Like, they have a lot of pride in that room. They didn't want to go to 0-3 in the league. I don't know how much of what I'm saying is being repetitive. I apologize. But I'm not stunned at all that they stole one. I did not think it was going to be Cornell. I thought Cornell, having watched them in person, I was up there at Sholokov watching them dismantle my alma mater, and then I thought they really took a step against Princeton. I just thought Firth and Goldstein would be too much for their for Yale's Poles, who still have inexperience. But it's a huge win. And listen, this is what I've always said. The Ivy is just a fish tank that I know more about, but I know people who studied the Big East or the Patriot League would say the same thing, where these are leagues where there's a ton of coaching staff and cultural continuity. The coordinators know each other really well. So when you think about setting the table for a potential trap, like this has a lot of those things, right? And it's why consistently there are tournament teams from these leagues that go like 500 in the league and don't even like win their own conference, even though they're really good, right? So, you know, the 2-3-4 in the Ivy is always rock solid. And I think what was different this year is, like, I think there's three teams that have front end talent that everyone thinks will be there, right? It's in no particular order: Harvard, Princeton, Cornell. And then there's kind of this like logjam of teams that, you know, A, there's been head coaching turnover in both at Penn and Brown. And also, you know, you have like the emergence of Dartmouth into that bucket. And then Yale has gone from the first bucket to now in the rock fight. So like they're in the mud scratching and clawing. But Yale's talented. I mean, this is a freshman class that was recruited right on the back of that national championship, right? So these are like, they have some high-end young kids on the offense that are starting to get going here. But do I think that they've like solved all their deficiencies? No, not at all. And I think that, you know, it'll be really interesting to see who ends up stealing that four seed.
Nick, you got anything on the Bulldogs?
It's something that I don't think I would have admitted a couple years back. But Ivy League is similar levels of fun. Who's going to pick off who? And, you know, this being kind of the first big instance of it, it's only going to make me tune into and follow more of, you know, what Larkin just alluded to, kind of the quote unquote bottom four. Like, Dartmouth played Harvard close not too long ago. Who's Brown gonna try and take a stab at? And then Yale Penn, you know, I hate to say that I'm actually enjoying to see how the Ivy League is going to shake off, and you know, who's going to take down and give Harvard their first conference loss. Princeton looks unstoppable and undeniable at times, but you know, they have a lot. I don't know. It's fun. It's fun to watch, you know, the nerds scatter about.
It's fun. Great analysis from Nick Asell. Let's bring this podcast in for a close with a couple of quick hitters. Was that game in Columbus or State College? But either way, Penn State Columbus took care of business against Ohio State. The Buckeyes continue to struggle offensively. 13-6 business-like win. And the Nittany Lions, I believe, go to 6-3 on the season behind. Again, balanced scoring effort. 2 goals and 2 assists from Jack Iantano and 2 goals and an assist from Chase Robertson. Elsewhere in the Big Ten, and this is what I wanted to get to, 8 goals from Eric Spanos as he makes his return from injury, and the Terps pull away late from the Michigan Wolverines. But the talking point from this one was a clip of Mark Dixon chastising Leo Johnson for some post-goal-scoring chirping at the defender. He did made a similar comment about a Rutgers goal scorer against Hopkins on Sunday. Nick, this is right up your alley, so we're going to start with you. Your thoughts on post-goal trash talk?
I made this point on Twitter for Dixon to say, you know, look at the Maryland greats. Guys like Matt Rambo never did this. I'm like, no. I've heard Rambo say some devious shit in hotel lobbies. I'm sure he's saying the same thing on the golf course, and you better believe he said it on the offense, you know, when he was carrying Maryland to a title. It's fun. I'm sorry. You might not like it. I don't care if a broadcaster, you know, doesn't, you know, wants to poo-poo a little smack talk afterwards. The thing about getting in a defender's face after you score a goal. It's one of the beautiful things about lacrosse. There's going to be another chance to get got, and it only elevates the stakes of the individual matchups and is going to make each team push harder. When you hit a goal and you say your mom flew all the way out here just so that you could take a dump in your pants and get scored on like that, tell her I say what's up. It's the pinnacle of sports, and it's why you play. And people, and when you put your helmet away for the last time, there are two things that you'll miss most, me in particular. One, the locker room banter where you're slandering your guys. And then the second is that moment where, as a defender, you cause a turnover, push transition, and you and your attackman or you and your midi are running off. Wow, that's 15 steps worth of the most heinous shit you can think of off the top of your mind. And then when you score on your defender, and I think I've talked about it before, the thing I miss the most about college and professional sports was somebody doing that to me. And then on the next rep, I'm like, dude, this game's going to end. People are going to forget about this game, but you're still going to be ugly. And you have to look like that the rest of your life. Oh, what I'd give to just call someone ugly in the middle of a lacrosse game one more time. Dixon, let the boys have fun and try not to use Rambo as the moral compass for how people should act. Larkin, were you weren't too much of a trash talker, were you?
No, not really. I mean, where I push back on Dix is, like, the truth of the matter is I was...
In your bedroom?
I was let into college to keep the ball out of the net. Like I took a spot from someone with a better score and better grades, right? If someone wants to run their mouth after blowing by me and blowing up by Jack Kelly, that's his prerogative, and I have no issue with that. So the key to the clip that I would push back on Dixon is it was a good play. He hammered a lefty goal. He scored. They're trying to revive their season. They're trying to show some fight, some bounce. And, you know, when you're looking for some bounce in hockey, as an example, you send your biggest, toughest guy over the boards, and he lays overhand rights after running his mouth, right? Like, this is Darwinistic. This is the law of the jungle. Now, the one thing I will say is this is not a sport where you're allowed to respond to that in a manner that you are allowed in indoor lacrosse or in the NHL. So this is a sport where you can really run your mouth as a fake tough guy at attack who doesn't have to answer the bell. So I see both sides. I'm like, you know, that wasn't my style, but I have no problem with someone doing it. You know, to each their own. Half these kids grew up idolizing Kobe Bryant. Like, has anyone ever watched him, talk? Like, and he did because no one worked harder in the gym, and he had a process, and, like, he believed the ball was going in. So, yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it, you know. I've never heard Tom Schreiber say anything ever, but that doesn't mean you can't do it the other way.
Yeah, it's just – one point to make with respect to Mark's point of view is that he's an official, right? So that definitely informs a lot of his perspective. And, you know, when you're an official and your job is to keep the game under control, making sure that kids don't cross lines in terms of the things they say are one of the ways to do it, one of the important ways to do it. And so I can understand, as a broadcaster, you know, that kind of bleeding into your point of view as well. You know, obviously, we just finished talking about Yale. That's where Leo Johnson spent his undergraduate career. That is a program that is well known for the amount of shit that they talk, to the point where some pregame mechanics were altered after the 2018 quarterfinals.
Hold on real quick. 2 points. Let me just give a quick power ranking of the teams that I've played that have talked the most shit. One, Yale, two, any service academy, which I think would surprise a lot of people, three, UNC, four, Harvard, five, Virginia. And if you're a kid listening to this, maybe, probably.
Okay. Because they were well known.
Drexel
for it as well.
Is right up there. Drexel's fans were
the worst I've ever heard. West Philly's finest, baby.
Oh my God. Yeah, those five Philly guys who were just showing up with brown bags. Oh my God.
Larkin, what were your rankings?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Yale thing. Here's the one piece of advice I give to young kids listening or to parents like wondering how far they should let their kid run their mouth. don't be the guy on the sideline who hasn't even earned his stripes and isn't even on the turf, running your mouth in a warm-up or, you know, in the facility. Like, you earn the right with your product to talk. And if Matt Rambo wants to go overhand left and then, you know, represent Philly the way some guys do, he can. I mean, he won the tour time. He's really good. And so that gets back to my pushback on Dix, where it's, you know, like, I get it. I see it. But, yeah, I will say, like, I wish lacrosse was allowed to be more physical. I'm a defender. Nick's a defender. Nick goes high and late. He wants to slide with his body, and he wants people to pay the price if he dodges the middle. And Mark Dixon's taken that out of the game, and the rules committees have taken that out of the game, right? And I'm not trying to single him out, but I do mean, like, I mean with respect, you know, there was a time.
Have taken it out of the game.
There was a time where if you ran an inside slant in the NFL, like, you're waking up a week later potentially, and that goes into earning the right to run your mouth. That's no longer the case in lacrosse. Hitting too hard is 2 minutes locked in. That's a fact. You know, we're giving out flags on the clears. People are getting brown. A brown midfielder got called for a 2 minute unreleasable for hitting too hard with the ball on a stick on the clear. I've never even seen that. So, you know, I just think that the good news is if any of these guys want to go play indoor lacrosse, we will figure out really quickly who runs their mouth or who doesn't.
Okay. And Mark, it's my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing to say to players I coach, especially if I'm on the sidelines. You know, usually I don't coach individual teams. It'll just be players. But like, if they start running their mouth, and it's a kid who's not, you know, not working hard enough in practice to run his mouth on game day, just it's, hey, you're not good enough to say that. Like, don't ever say that again, because you haven't earned the right to talk to that guy who, by the way, just bitched you five times in a row, and that's your first win today. Like, you're 1 for 5, and you have the audacity to run your mouth. Like, stay humble. I'm suiting up on Monday for practice.
We got some juice in the podcast today. I'm fired up right now.
Yeah.
You might have earned us the explicit tag. There were a few aggressive.
Me?
Yeah, oh, Brown boy. State, the public university of Rhode Island coming through.
Hello, juice.
I think that's a good note to end on. So as always, if you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. We'll be back later in the week. More Inside Lacrosse podcast. And we'll be back next week where, if history is any indication, we're going to be talking about Duke beating Virginia, because I believe they've done it 21 times in a row in the regular season. But it is certainly going to be an exciting game, and it is one of a excellent slate. So in the meantime, have a blessed Easter week, and we'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcasts. Love you, Nick.
Love you, Terry.
I'm swearing.
Love you, Larkin.
My family's not going to like that.
Yeah, Palm Sunday of all things. Unbelievable.